Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Presidential adviser Karl Rove is testifying before a grand jury for the fourth time today about whether he leaked the name of an undercover CIA agent. The investigation is one of many clouds on the horizon for President Bush, who is taking a beating in the polls and on late-night television.
According to the latest poll, it's interesting, only 2% of African Americans think that President Bush is doing a good job. 2%, yeah. Probably the percentage would have been higher, but Condoleezza Rice has a small family.
That's late-night comedian Conan O'Brien. The president is also dealing with the aftermath of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, the troubled nomination of Harriet Myers to the Supreme Court, increasing violence in Iraq, and several investigations into top Republicans, which appear to be having an effect on public attitudes. Several polls show the president's overall approval rating has sunk to all-time lows, 39% in the Wall Street Journal and NBC polls, 38% at the Pew Research Center. Joining us on the line from Washington is Andrew Kohut. He's director of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. And Andrew, a 38% approval rating for the president, what does that mean?
Well, it means for the second month in a row, President Bush's approval ratings have hit a low for his presidency. And there is discontent with domestic matters. There's discontent with the war in Iraq. And the public is very displeased with the way things are going in the country. And there's a fair amount of view that this president will be an unsuccessful president. 41% said that history may judge President Bush as unsuccessful. Only 26% said successful. And that's the first time the public has come to that summary judgment about the way history may regard George W. Bush.
So you've never asked that question in a poll before?
We have asked it before, but in every other case, we found plurality saying President Bush will be judged as successful.
And when you talk about the war in Iraq, what are the numbers there?
Well, an ever-growing higher percentage say that we made the wrong decision in using force. We have an increasing number of people, of as many as 47%, saying bring the troops home now. Only 48% say keep the troops there till the situation is stable. A majority say a timetable should be set. And there's a general recognition or perception that things are not going well there.
Were there any positive numbers for the president?
You know, we've looked very hard, and this is one of those polls where we don't see much good for President Bush. The only positive is that the public continues to see the president as having improved things with respect to national security. The one thing the president has going for him is he still has 80% approval level among Republicans. But even that is down from 90%.
And personal character numbers are steady, right?
You know, they have declined as well. And the most important decline has been the view that President Bush is a strong leader. And this is fallout from Katrina. We now find sharply lower percentages saying President Bush is a strong leader. We have to go back to Richard Nixon, who was beginning to battle Watergate in 1973 to get a lower rating. And I think President Nixon's rating was 32, and as we've noted, President Bush's rating is 38.
That's Andrew Kohut, director of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. And now, joining us to talk more about this, we'll have two political reporters with us. First, Gail Chadwick covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. Hi, Gail.
Hello.
Also, John McKinnon, he covers the White House for the Wall Street Journal. Welcome, John.
Thanks.
In today's Washington Post, one Republican called the series of Washington scandals a perfect storm for the GOP. Would you describe it that way, John?
I don't think it can possibly get a lot worse. The Republicans are really facing so many challenges on so many fronts that I think even some Democrats and even some former Clinton administration officials are at least privately expressing some sympathy for them. It's that bad.
Mm-hmm. And Karl Rove, as we said, White House Deputy Chief of Staff Karl Rove is testifying before the grand jury for the fourth time today. Why has he been called back? Can you summarize that for us, Gail?
He's been called back because there's been more revelations about contacts. In particular, Judith Miller spoke of contacts that had been not previously disclosed with him and with Scooter Libby. Although much of the questioning of her appears to have focused on Mr. Libby, that's chief of staff for the vice president, more than Mr. Rove.
And John, how big of a story is this in Washington right now?
In Washington, it's practically the only thing that people are talking about right now, at least as far as I can tell. I think out in the real world, outside the Beltway, it's probably not that much of a focus of attention right now. But you know, the truth is it could become a big, big story out there pretty soon, because there is sort of a feeling among the lawyers working on this case that as the grand jury wraps up, or is scheduled to wrap up at the end of this month, it's likely that whatever indictments are going to come are going to begin to come in the next week or two.
You've also reported, John, that Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald may be investigating a larger conspiracy?
Sure. I mean, that's one of the ways that this could become a really big story, because if you've just got an isolated, let's say, instance of perjury on the part of one or two mid-level White House officials, that's going to be, you know, a big embarrassment for the White House, but not a giant catastrophe. But if you've got a situation where a lot of officials sat down, worked out a strategy for leaking material that they shouldn't have leaked, that was classified or otherwise protected, then you you begin to see the outlines of a conspiracy that could potentially draw in you know, some very big names.
Mm-hmm. And this investigation, in terms of distracting the Bush administration, some are speculating that some of the president's recent troubles really stem from Karl Rove not being able to fully focus on his job. For example, yesterday, the president's live video conference with soldiers in Iraq, there have been a lot of questions about how staged that video conference was. Do you think that would have been different under Rove, or are we seeing sort of strains here because of Rove's not focusing on what's happening in the White House?
Well, Karl Rove has never been one not to stage manage things, so I think if Karl didn't have a big role in that event yesterday, it probably would have looked pretty similar. I did find that event to be a little bit flawed, but a lot of the president's events in recent times have been, you know, criticized on that score. But yeah, he's been a little bit less present at some of the big events that have gone on in the last few weeks, and there is strong speculation out there that he's not quite the player that he was. There's a thought that he wasn't as involved in the Harriet Myers nomination as he was in some previous big decisions.
Mm-hmm. Gail, let's also talk about former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, who some people say is really the real power in Congress. He was ordered to turn over some phone records yesterday by those investigating money laundering charges against him. What does that mean for him?
Well, he is facing a court date at the end of the month. He's still... I mean, some of the questions that have been raised about the phone records is, what an odd time to subpoena them at this point for an investigation that's been going on this long. But I think it's clear that the prosecutor is trying to get more solid evidence in this case. But regardless of the outcome in Texas, the sense on Capitol Hill is that Mr. DeLay will very likely never come back into a full leadership position. The speaker is trying very hard to keep a leadership fight from breaking out into the open, but in fact it's already begun. And I think it's interesting for both in the White House and the congressional side, this is an operation that's run very, very tightly. Tax cuts every year, close votes that are passed, committee chairmen that are removed from their position if they vote against the party line. And suddenly, both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue are under real siege. And there is a very serious possibility, not just of a turnover in elections in 2006, but of significant changes in leadership right now.
Mm-hmm. And what about the investigation of lobbyist Jack Abramoff and his ties to other politicians?
Well, when you and John were talking earlier, could things get worse? I would say yes, they could, and that's the button to push. Because Abramoff's ties with all across the Capitol Hill, with many members of Congress, if that begins to crumble, I think you're going to see Democrats jump on a national campaign on corruption that will be pretty much cribbed from the Republican playbook in 1994, that this is a majority that's grown arrogant in power and deserves to be put out of office. Mm-hmm. And the Abramoff connection has a capacity to touch many more people than just the problems at the top with DeLay and Senator Frist.
Mm-hmm. And what about, obviously, Supreme Court nominee Harriet Myers? Is her nomination in jeopardy at all because we haven't been able to build a consensus? The White House hasn't been able to build a consensus around it?
Well, I'm probably the only one in Washington that thinks that she has a powerful set of allies that haven't weighed in publicly yet, and that's the business community. They're very interested in having a second member on the court with the kind of on-the-ground business credentials that she has, someone who understands that what courts do can actually make it very difficult for Main Street to function. And they are quietly backing her. In the end, this comes down to what 100 senators decide to do. The Democrats, I think, are holding their counsel because they're afraid that if she is eliminated, you'll get Bork too, the kind of conservative that the movement conservatives really wanted. Republicans are facing some odd problems of their own. They've been telling Democrats all along, look, it's not enough just to say we don't like this nominee, we prefer someone different. You have to support the president unless you can find something very serious wrong with the qualifications. It's not clear that they're going to be able to do that. They've also said to Democrats, you can't question a nominee on issues likely to come before the court, and yet that's exactly what conservatives now say that they want to do. So in the end, they're facing a real bind, hypocrisy for one, and second, do they really want to cross the business community and Pat Roberts, who said that any Republican that votes against a conservative Christian nominee nominated by a conservative Christian president is going to face real problems from social conservatives.
Mm-hmm. And John, just briefly, your prediction about Harriet Myers?
I think it's up in the air right now. I do agree that the administration has given leadership in the Senate a lot of what they asked for in this nomination, and I think Pat Roberts, the Kansas senator, those are words that, you know, his colleagues in the Senate will have to pay attention to. But, the president is so weak right now that he doesn't really have a lot of political capital left to spend on anything. And it may be in the end that the criticism from social conservatives is going to be too much for this nominee.
All right. Well, thanks to both of you for speaking with us. Gail Chadwick covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. John McKinnon covers the Wall Street Journal, covers the White House for the Wall Street Journal. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. A deadly strain of avian flu has made its way to Europe. International health experts are confirming that diseased birds have been found in Turkey, and scientists are working to determine whether a virus infecting birds in Romania is the same strain of the disease. Health officials say there's no cause for panic because the risk of transmission to humans is relatively low, but there is concern that if the virus mutates to transmit from human to human, it could create a worldwide pandemic. Dr. Arnold Manto is an epidemiologist with the University of Michigan School of Public Health, the World Health Organization designated influenza center, and he joins us on the line. Welcome, doctor.
Hello.
Europeans, how are they reacting to this news that the avian flu was found in Eastern Europe?
Well, I think they're very concerned because it's in their backyard. It actually was predicted when it was discovered to be in migratory birds in Asiatic Russia and in Kazakhstan. And so it's pretty well following the kind of route that was expected.
Has it gotten there faster than expected?
Not really, because we're getting into the autumn migratory season. And, for example, the Netherlands decided, since they had experience with another kind of bird flu, to start keeping their poultry undercover to minimize the contact with migratory birds.
And this strain of the virus is what kind of strain, and how disturbing is this particular strain?
Well, the strain that's been confirmed in Turkey is the bad one, the H5N1 virus, which causes deaths of poultry and which is occasionally transmitted to humans.
So there have been human deaths in Turkey from this?
Not that we know of. But remember, the number of total confirmed deaths is just a little more than 60 in all of Southeast Asia, and they've had a lot of poultry spread. So it's a very sporadic in spreading to people.
I'm wondering, what kind of steps are folks taking to try to prevent the spread of this? And if this is the bad strain that we're talking about here, how do we know that it's contained?
Well, we don't know that it's contained, and it's going to be a big challenge to contain it. And I think we should keep a couple of things separate. First of all, this may have an enormous economic consequence in areas in Europe where it transmits, because they're going to have to cull the chickens. If there are no chickens, there's going to be no chicken in the market. It's not an issue of spreading from chickens, but they're just by eating them, but there just won't be any chickens. Second question, human transmission. We don't know what it will take to make this virus start transmitting from person to person. The viruses that have come from the people, the small number, have been fully avian. They haven't changed. But the more there is the possibility of human transmission from birds to humans, the greater the probability of a mutation, which could let it transmit from person to person.
Should Americans be concerned about this?
Well, yes, I think we should be concerned, because there is the possibility that this will happen. It's a random event, and random events will be more likely if there are more chances for them to occur. And if there's a lot of transmission from bird to bird, then there will be cases of going from bird to human, and that's when the problem may arise.
I'm assuming if we don't know exactly how it might be transmitted, we may not also know how to vaccinate against it.
Well, I think we know how to vaccinate against it, but we don't have a vaccine for a couple of reasons. First of all, right now it takes a lot of this virus in the vaccine to get an immune response. We don't respond well to this particular avian strain. That's point number one. Point number two, we haven't really manufactured anything more than a small amount of this vaccine, and it won't go very far because the amount we need to inject. So we really don't have a vaccine as yet, but we do know that the antiviral Tamiflu does work against it. But again, our stockpiles, because of purchase issues, because of production issues, are pretty small.
Mm-hmm. So Tamiflu definitely does work against this?
Tamiflu definitely does work against it. My colleagues and I have done some studies in mice in which it may take a longer course, more than the 5 days, to treat, but it looks like the current dose is effective. We may also need a step up in the dose. And the problem is there have been so few cases in Asia that doing studies on exactly how it works and whether we're going to need a step up in dose have not really been done.
Can you just briefly explain what Tamiflu is for our listeners? And also, would you advise that people try to get a flu shot?
Well, I would always advise people to get a flu shot. Mm-hmm. And there's a practical reason here, and that is one of the ways that avian flu, and this is especially true in the areas which are having avian flu, because one of the ways it may change to be able to transmit from person to person is actually sharing the genetic material between an avian strain and a human strain in a person who's infected with both. Now, if we prevent regular flu, we'll prevent that from occurring. And chances are we are not going to see avian flu this winter. We're going to see regular flu, and every year an average of 36,000 Americans die of flu. So the thing really to be most worried about is regular flu this winter. The avian flu, we may have it, we may not have it, and I think we as a country have to plan for this event. But on an individual basis, there's not a whole lot people can do.
And so plan in terms of what as a country?
Plan in terms of making the research and the stockpiling of the vaccine. And we can't stockpile until we're really sure what we need, because we may need extra things, adjuvants in the vaccine. That's one phase. Get more of the antiviral, and that is happening. And plan for all the surge in hospitalizations and medical demands and the rest, which may occur if we do have the pandemic.
Dr. Monto, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Arnold Monto of the University of Michigan School of Public Health. Next week on Here and Now, Saddam Hussein goes on trial Wednesday. What was it like to work for him? We'll talk with someone who can answer that. Also, we speak with former Beatle wife Cynthia Lennon. That's next week. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. The Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Los Angeles this week released confidential files of 126 priests accused of sexually molesting children. The documents reveal more than seven decades of sexual abuse by clergy and cover-ups and denials by church leaders, including Cardinal Roger Mahoney. More than 560 claims have been filed. Eric Barragan is a plaintiff in the case against the Archdiocese. Eric and his brothers Manuel and Edgar were sexually abused by Father Carlos Rene Rodriguez, who pled guilty and is now serving 8 years in prison. Eric, you wanted these files released. Are you satisfied that the truth is finally getting out?
I am not satisfied whatsoever.
Why not?
Because they have distributed information that is completely incomplete and incorrect. This last update that came out that was supposed to describe date by date and incidents of when the Archdiocese knew what they knew, our information is not in there. The fact that he was arrested, that there were other claims against him, that there's actually six victims that have come forward to press charges against Rodriguez, it only states one.
And what do you hope comes out of all this, Eric?
Well, my hope and my brother's hopes is that the accountability of the hierarchy of the Archdiocese is held. No one has come forward to apologize. No one has come forward to say we could have prevented this. Who are the people that were reported, that we reported to in 2000, even before all the other scandals broke out? We had gone to the church and asked for help and asked for Rodriguez to be removed or something, and they held on to our case for over a year until finally I had to go to the district attorney and the police and file criminal charges because the L.A. Archdiocese was not moving, and none of that information has been made public, and no one is being held accountable for the actions against my brothers and I.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that the release would make things better?
Of course it would, because then it would really show the vastity of the corruption in the church, of how they manipulated the system, how they hid and protected the priests, and how they did not protect their flock. The Catholic Church is the people. Unfortunately, it's the hierarchy that have been hiding the truth and not been accountable, and that's what's hurting our church.
Eric Barragan is a plaintiff in the Los Angeles clergy sexual abuse case. Father Tom Doyle is a Dominican priest who's an expert witness for the Los Angeles District Attorney. As a canon lawyer working for the Vatican's Washington office during the 1980s, Doyle co-wrote a report arguing that the church should do more to stop the abuse. He was fired from his job and has been working on behalf of victims ever since. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
How is the case in Los Angeles different from the highly publicized cases in Boston and Philadelphia?
The extent of the abuse and the cover-up is far worse than what has happened in Boston or Philadelphia or anywhere else in the United States. Second, I believe, well, I don't believe, I know that the Archbishop of Los Angeles spent far more money, time, and energy in blocking the discovery of the files and the information held by the diocese than any other bishop in the United States. And contrary to what the Archdiocese attorney has claimed, that the cardinal wanted to be as transparent as possible, the reality is simply the opposite of that. They wanted to be anything but transparent and open. and spent millions of dollars in unsuccessful ventures to block discovery of these files.
But now that they've been released, many folks are criticizing the release of them, saying that they've been heavily sanitized.
Well, the thing is that in releasing the files, the diocese, the archdiocese, really created an illusion of being open and forthright with the public, which was certainly not the case. They released, it's true, sanitized summaries of the cases, which give out more information than was previously known. But it's a far cry from what happened in Boston or Philadelphia, where the files themselves, the truth itself, was disclosed.
Mm-hmm. So then why release these heavily sanitized documents if the information is going to come out eventually? Is it just a public relations move? Is that what you're saying?
It's primarily a public relations move by the Archdiocese. And secondly, it is a move that they had to go along with because of intense pressure from the media, from the victims and their attorneys, and also the fact that they have lost every motion that they have placed to retain the files and the summaries. The grand jury wanted to obtain these, and a couple of years ago, Cardinal Mahoney conjured up this concept called a formation privilege, claiming that all communications between a bishop and priests are privileged information because of the nature of the relationship. I was involved in that argument, helping the district attorney. There's no basis for that in common law, continental law, canon law, or church theology.
The church has said in its defense that the release of these files will show that its response to sexual abuse complaints has evolved, and perhaps in the 80s it was commonly believed that treatment could help and priests could be returned to the ministry, but now in hindsight they know that that is not the case. Is there evidence in these files at all of a sort of evolution of thinking on the church's part?
Absolutely not. That's hogwash. The only reason they're releasing the files is because they were forced to release them, and the only reason that this archdiocese and many others have responded to the insistence of the public and of the civil law community to do something responsibly with regard to clergy sex abuse is because they've been forced. Had the media and the courts of our country not done what they did, the cover-up would be continuing, and the victims would still be treated as they had been traditionally. It is not because the church didn't understand. Nobody in their right mind can claim that sexual abuse of a minor by an adult is not problematic and harmful.
So why didn't the church act?
Basically, I believe they didn't act because what was most important was the power and the prestige of the ruling class of the bishops. I think another thing that's important is the fact that those ruling the church are not, they're celibates. They've never been parents, and I don't think they fully appreciate the devastation that happens with sexual abuse. And I think another important reason is the Catholic Church's philosophy of human sexuality, which is very, very restricted and in many ways archaic. In other words, they didn't understand. We're not capable of understanding how devastating sexual abuse can be. It ruins people's lives.
You know, you gave up your career to work with victims. You lost your job as the Vatican's canon lawyer, as we said, and you also lost your job as an Air Force chaplain. Some said that was because you were advocating for victims. Why stay involved with this?
I stay involved with the advocacy for the victims because I think it's right. I think it's the right thing to do because I still love and believe in the church as the people of God, as the Christian community. But the church is not the bishops. It's not the papacy, it's the people. To me, the most important people in the church are those who are most vulnerable, and that's the victims.
Father Doyle, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Father Tom Doyle has been an expert witness in hundreds of clergy sex abuse cases and is currently working on the cases in Los Angeles. You're listening to Here and Now.
We'll be right back.
Today marks the 111th birthday of well-loved American poet E.E. Cummings. His work is coming to life today thanks to a recently released CD titled The Voice of the Poet E.E. Cummings, where Cummings recites some of his popular works.
In just spring, when the world is mud luscious, the little lame balloon man whistles far and we.
That was E.E. Cummings reading an excerpt of his poem In Just. His poetry will be read at his gravesite this weekend in Massachusetts, where local poets and fans will pay tribute to Cummings. Boston poet Charles Coe is performing at one of the events to mark Cummings' birthday, and he joins us in studio. Welcome, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You know, when we hear words like mud luscious, that was really Cummings' style in a way, wasn't it? Can you describe what that style means to you and why you became such a Cummings fan?
His style to me is permission to play and experiment. You know, if you look at early 20th century poetry, it was a very serious affair. And I don't mean that as a criticism, just a description. And Cummings really gave a lot of poets the permission to experiment with topics, with the typography of the words on the page, the music of the work, and it really inspired a lot of people to sort of start swinging their hips as far as the poetry is concerned. I've looked at a lot of his poems at the first pass, it's like, I just don't understand, but if you start to peel the layers of the onion and to read it again and again and to read it aloud, a meaning, your meaning, starts to sort of emerge from that and gives you access to the work.
And one poem where that style really comes across is One Slip Slouch Twee, written by Cummings in 1940. Would you mind reading that for us?
I sure will. One slip slouch twitter stamp coon with a plonky kerplung guitar. Please make me glad. This dum dam slam slum sloppity whirl. Show am wicked it are. Now here we come, dearie. Bud, who's gwanter hate dat hurtful world? No gal, no boy, dey simply loves it. For it's their pain, theirs, and nobody else's, and it's their joy. I kindly thank you.
Now that's difficult to understand. You did a great job of it, but it's difficult to understand. What does that mean to you?
Well, two people sitting and one guy's playing guitar, and he and his lady friend are sharing the joy and pain of the world, and maybe the joy and pain of their relationship.
I was reading it as you were reading it out loud, and on the page, how he sort of intersperses words along the page also gives it some of that meaning, which helps you interpret it. So there
Absolutely.
Again, we have another part of Cummings' style. And you know, he had great fans, but he also had serious critics who did not like that style at all.
Did not and do not.
Right. They said he lacked artistic growth, and then even the intent sometimes was elitist or self-indulgent. What would you say to those critics?
Well, I would say they're big, fat, poopy heads. on a serious note, what I would say is, you can look at it a couple of ways. He didn't develop a lot stylistically. You could also say that he found what worked for him and continued to do it. He had advanced degrees in English and the classics, so he knew the rules, and then he broke the rules.
What would you say his poetry means for you as a poet?
He was very concerned with the questions of life, of his own mortality and spirit, and those are important issues to me. I really relate a lot to the strong sense of feeling and emotion that comes through for me in his work.
Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
That's Boston poet Charles Coe. He'll be taking part in a tribute to E.E. Cummings at the poet's gravesite in Forest Hills in Boston this weekend. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now.
Let's play it with the introduction, please. Play the top of the overture, please.
Henry Purcell's 17th century Baroque opera, Dido and Aeneas, continues to speak to modern audiences. This weekend, the Handel and Haydn Society of Boston brings its production to the stage with a contemporary twist. While the basic theme is unchanged, that of love having the ability to both motivate and destroy, this production includes videography, a large reflecting pool with hundreds of gallons of water, and the artistic eye of Chinese stage director Shenji Shang. The opera is the story of Dido, the doomed queen of Carthage, who falls in love with Aeneas, the prince of Troy. Evil witches lure Aeneas to desert Dido, and heartbroken, she throws herself into a fire after singing one of the most famous of Purcell's arias, Dido's Lament. And stage director Shenji Shang joins us in studio, along with Handel and Haydn Society musical director Grant Llewellyn. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You both staged Dido and Aeneas before, yes? What's different about this version?
From my point of view, of course, the music is the music, and I'm looking at the same dots on the page as I was 4 or 5 years ago. But the great thing about early music is that so little is specified in terms of the tempos, even the orchestrations. And so there's still a lot up for grabs. And it's a new cast. So from my point of view, it feels like a completely new animal.
You know, your conception, your feeling about the story have changed considerably. And you suddenly realize you want to do it differently. I think this time I suddenly had different kind of emotion towards the story, and actually it disturbed me even more about a woman who actually had taken her life instead of going to Oprah's show talking about how pissed the guy walked out of her life. And she actually burned herself. That's pretty rare in modern time in 21st century.
Now, you've had extensive training in Chinese opera.
Yes.
What kind of influences might the audience notice in this production?
Well, the most Western operas exist in traditional Western opera that are pretty naturalistic. They tend to illustrate the music and illustrate the historical reference, background. To me, it was great working with Grant and the Handel Haydn says the music has already spoken. My job is really about bringing a modern association to the opera. So instead of telling people that the opera is, I'm more interested about what this opera could be in the 21st century.
Mm-hmm. But a big island is your single visual here. That's got to be difficult. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, I just thought it's, you know, for a woman tormented about her longing to a man, she eventually decided to give up her life for the love. And it's such a lonely sort of a decision. And I was on an airplane a lot. I saw this German Geo magazine. I saw this picture of a naked woman on an island, and you know, with all the water around. There's nothing on an island. And I thought it's similar to that very island of Carthage. And it's a short opera. I want to give the audience a very strong impression of Dido, where she is, at her emotional state, mm-hmm. and how her life, and she started alone, she ended alone.
I imagine, though, just going back to the water for a minute, Grant, there's got to be enormous logistical problems with that, yes?
Yes, well, you're turning to me. I'm the conductor. What do I know about logistics? From where I'm standing, it looks glorious, and I haven't had a single drop on me yet.
Well, there you go.
The musicians have towers on the side, and in case something ruin this period, expensive instruments, that would be just unbelievable.
It sounds as if that one of the themes here in your work together is kind of letting this organic production evolve. Do your musicians also go along well with that?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the joys of this period of music. Mm-hmm. And the kind of instrumentalists we have in the Handel and Haydn Society who do specialise on these early instruments, they know that the spirit of the age of this music is very improvisatory. Everything goes back to Dido's Lament. And actually Dido's music in general, listening to Zhizheng describing the island, Purcell even sets Dido on a sort of musical island within the opera. Her two significant arias are accompanied by a repetitive ground bass, as it's called, with a sort of an inevitability to the progression, to the musical progression, on which she then weaves her melody. And never do we hear Dido or even see Dido in a state of levity.
And at one point, Zhizheng, she may be naked in this production as well.
Yes, she's semi-naked.
Yeah, she will be. Yes. Is that a distraction or will that...
No. I think... I know Boston is a conservative town, I was told, and that, I'm just very interested in testing the audience's limits. I mean, it's something you really envision somebody pacing around her living room, pacing the coast with nobody around it. And you want to get this kind of intimacy, you want to get her into her world without doing this Victorian dresses to push people away. You want to go to the most intimate state of her emotion. So the nakedness, in a way, wasn't about being naked as idea. It's really about to reflect the naked emotional state, to draw audience into her interior world.
What do you want to come out of this collaboration? What do you think you want audiences to take away?
I'm from China. I never heard of classical music until I was a teenager. And I fell in love with Baroque music. And I thought, if this music can reach me that far, across to the Pacific Ocean, I think this music has same kind of power to reach any state, any kind of age of audience. And my goal is to really sort of delete all this baggage come with the music, and really put a clean, very modern set on stage to associate something of our modern time, our modern style, our feeling to the music. And then suddenly you realize this music is not old, it's just as modern, as contemporary as ever.
For all the conventions of the time, Purcell is as modern as the most innovative composers out there today. His use of line and harmony and rhythm is outrageous. And if we can bring people to this music again with fresh ears and listening to it as if it was just newly minted, then we've gone some way to achieve our goal.
Handel and Haydn music director Grant Llewellyn and stage director Shenji Sheng discussing their production of the opera Dido and Aeneas. For more information, go to our website here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.